So, hi everybody, welcome to class for those of you online. So, we'll begin this class by doing meditation first of all. We'll take reference together, say the prayers, and then I'll begin the actual class. So, please just get comfortable in your seat. Just have yourself back straight, shoulders relaxed. Put your hands in a place that they feel at ease, and let your body breathe itself. As the body breathes itself, just watch and relax into awareness itself. Imagine the ground beneath you is made of soft and starry sapphire light, and the space above you is filled with offerings and rainbows. And sitting amongst the rainbows and offerings is Shakyamuni Buddha. He's sitting on a large golden throne. He has the three robes of the monk. His right hand is in the earth touching mudra, while his left holds the begging bowl. Now surrounding him are many other enlightened beings. And surrounding you are all sentient beings. These will include your parents, family members, close friends, strangers, and difficult people. So consider how fortunate you are to still be alive today. And to be grateful for the leisure and opportunity you have to achieve your spiritual goals. We need to act on our appreciation. Because while we do have leisure and opportunity, things are not quite right. And this world does not exist as it seems to. Nevertheless, we have met a spiritual friend who is leading us in the safe direction of the three rare sublime ones. These being the Buddha, our teacher, the Dharma, the teachings themselves, and the spiritual community. Those beings who accompany us in our studies and practices. So it's our job here to lead all sentient beings in that safe direction. To do this as cleanly as possible, I want you to try to imagine yourself being as clear as a deity. And you're holding a mantra and a bell. And you're sitting within a sphere of great enjoyment. It's from a sphere of great enjoyment that you lead all the beings surrounding you in the safe direction of refuge. Affirming this, you say, "I go for refuge until I am enlightened through the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create for listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I am enlightened through the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create for listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I am enlightened through the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings." Then in response to this petition of ours, imagine that from the heart of each enlightened being above you, lights and nectar stream down, and these dissolve into yourself and all living beings surrounding you. And every negative karma and obstruction is purified. and your lifespan, your health, your virtues and realizations are increased. Cleansed by wisdom and fortified with compassionate love, I recollect the four immeasurable thoughts. And in the sight of devotees yourself, and establish all beings within these four immeasurable states. With firmness, you say, may all sentient beings have happiness and its causes. May all sentient beings be free from suffering and its causes. May all sentient beings never be separated from the happiness that is without suffering. May all sentient beings abide in equanimity, free from the bias of attachment for friends and hatred for enemies. And in response to this wish of yours, from the heart of each enlightened being, lights of nectar stream down. And these dissolve into yourself and all living beings surrounding you. And all negative karmas and obstructions are purified. And your health and lifespan, your virtues and realizations are increased. Cleansed by the wisdom and fortified with compassionate love, you exhale and just relax. From that relaxed state of awareness, you invite the field for accumulating merit and each appear. In this case, it is the Buddha himself. And so we're going to recite the mantra of Buddha just three times to clear away and make everything perfect for us to study. So please join me in saying, Tayata Om Mahamunaya Soha Tayata Om Muni Mahamunaya Soha Tayata Om Muni Mahamunaya Soha. Let's recite this mantra a few more times under your breath. And I think that you have great control and mastery over all the different delusions. You've accomplished your own welfare and you're in a position to accomplish the welfare of others. Acknowledge that this ability to free yourself from suffering and its causes and help others to do the same depends upon study, reflection and meditation, and this is what you are prepared to do. And breathing in through your nostrils, exhale through your mouth, and let your eyes flutter open if they're closed. Okay, so last week we introduced the concept of these eight worldly concerns and the sort of loss and gain, pain and pleasure, notoriety or infamy and fame, and blame and praise. These are known as the eight worldly concerns, and to all of these concerns we have antidotes. Now, again, if you remember, it's not so much that loss and gain and pain and pleasure and so forth are the real source of our suffering. It's the responses that we have to them. And these responses are primarily attachment, also known as our clinging, and aversion, when we're pushing away. But these two responses really create the problems, and not so much what we gain, what we lose, and so forth. Now, the material I've drawn is primarily from these four books here. a book there called How to Practice Dharma by Lama Zobo Busha is a really in-depth but easy to read. It's a terrific real overview of this whole topic and quite in-depth. I don't think there's another book about this topic like it. Another very good one is Science and Philosophy in the Indian Buddhist classics. And this one is about the mind. And it hears a really great commentary on Abhidhamma's holiness of Dalai Lama. So I've never come across another commentary like that either. It's quite short, but it tells you how you develop our equanimity towards each other's concerns, which I haven't discovered in any other text. Today, we're going to look at our relationship to our possessions, and it's particularly in terms of gain and loss, and also feelings. So we have feelings of pleasurable feelings and painful feelings. So some of them we're going to be attached to and cling to, and others we're going to be averse to and try and push them away. So we'll look at these two pairs, and then we look at the antidotes to them. So basically, I'll introduce one phenomena first, the section on possessions, gain and loss, brief overview of it, and then look at each one you can overcome, the clinging or the aversion to it. So here are our first two pairs of mundane concern, and as you can see, they deal with possessions and feelings. And so once we have this, the pair, you know, so we're looking at external security. This is gain and loss. So we're often delighted when we win or get the things that we particularly want. The things that we overestimate our delight in it. And that's just through the misapprehension of the object itself. But on the other side, we have the other behavior, where we sort of overestimate the negative qualities of these objects. So I think you can see it's quite easy to see what we're really talking about here. The advice we get about trying to overcome these eight concerns is to not look for them too much. Because these are really hard to get rid of. Actually, you'll need to go you'll be practicing for quite a long time to actually get rid of these. Because they exist in terms of different levels. So a really sort of simple way of getting at them. But then there's this another way and then another. So we've got self-cherishing, self-grasping, and then just this most sort of gross behaviors towards them. So it does take a lot of effort, but as holiness gives the advice, is, but don't look for these things like too much. Don't over-invest them, in other words, we sort of say. We can't avoid gain and loss, pleasure and pain. But that's can't be done. What we need to do is adjust our behaviors or our responses in relationship to gain and loss, pleasure and pain. Yeah, so Nagarjuna teaches that the issue is not having or encountering the eight worldly concerns, but becoming obsessed with them. Or it's our attitude toward gain and loss, praise and blame, pleasure and pain and so forth, not their mere presence that determines whether we're at peace or whether we start to suffer. So we'll look first now at gain and loss. These two phenomena involve external security. So let's put this picture up, as you can see. And it's sort of like a fellow who's created a home, you know, his castle, his fortress. But he's built it out of sand right where the sea comes from, right? So even though it might look really great, he's really happy with it. Over time, that fortress is going to be sort of like washed away. But it will not provide him with the security he's actually seeking. So these pair of gain and loss fundamentally relate to external security, because they represent the clinging to material and financial success and the aversion to lacking possessions, which are the objects that normal people believe provide stability. Now, most people in Australia, they want a house, don't they? Everyone's their own place, right? It's like security. And I'm sure this is all around the world. Everybody wants a place to live. And what if that's, you know, not so much the problem, but if you get obsessed with it, now you've got a problem.
Oh, just before class, me and Manny were talking about the suffering of being a hoarder.
Yes.
Because I'm pretty sure that the hoarding mentality is kind of universal, but when you live in a throwaway culture like ours, then it's like our culture is a great enabler. And so, you know, there's just so much stuff everywhere to hoard.
Yeah.
And it's just like this. Yeah, you hoard until you can't even move in your own house. And it's incredible suffering.
Yeah, it is. See, isn't it? You watch those shows on television, boy. So the attachment, so the possessing of the articles does not make these people happy. Does it add to their happiness? Which is what they're sort of thinking it would, eh? Because nobody's doing it to suffer more, right? You need to try to be happier. But this does not take place. And you see this again and again and again. Not too long ago, I read an article about billionaires, you know, and they asked the billionaires, well, how much more money do you need to be sort of content? It was like $100 million. I just need another $100 million, and that'd be right. It's like, amazing, isn't it?
$100 million.
And then when they get that, come on. Yeah. And we've seen, I've read a number of biographies of some of the richest people in the world. Oh, they're not happy people. Having the wealth does not ensure your happiness. I think we all sort of know this just from our own experience. But the idea of it is like, you know, well, don't forget. You know, become obsessed with wealth, thinking having wealth will make you happy, but it won't. It just won't, and it can't. I remember many years ago when I first came to the Dharma, yeah, so happiness, like, what is it? Is that a physical quality or a mental quality? Mental, eh? Mental thing, right? So that's, so it's if you wish to be happy, its cause has to be mental, and then the effect will be mental. So anyway, so I'm just new to the Dharma, I come in, I'm Muslim. And then the teacher asked something about drug use. And, you know, so I was a drug user. And of course, like, I'm not using drugs to become unhappy. Someone does that. You use it to make yourself feel good and feel happier. But isn't that so? That's what I'm thinking about. Holy heck, it can't be done. Because the drugs are physical phenomena, they cannot produce the mental phenomena I'm seeking. So that was a great lesson for me. It's like, why not? You know, the point was going towards that direction to try and be happy because it cannot create it. Which, you know, you sort of know, you become a drug addict, right? It's not a happy life. You'd like to be happy. And like I said, the source, because of the physical phenomena, can't produce the mental phenomena. So it's wrong place. Cause and effect, kind of cause and effect. Physical stuff produces physical stuff. Mental stuff produces mental stuff. So if we want happiness, it's a mental phenomenon. So we're going to have to look in mental places, not external places. The pursuit of gain is driven by the desire for external security. But this attachment, in this overestimation of gain, makes the mind perpetually dissatisfied and unstable, as it remains subject to the emotional roller coaster of elation when things are obtained and dejection when they are lost. So the obsession is ineffective because worldly happiness is ultimately deceptive. So worldly happiness is like saying, you know, like if you possess, get enough external things, you'll be happy. But that's not true. That's deceptive.
It's kind of like a bit of a trap, because whilst you can get a few more things, you think it'll be possible.
Oh, you know, right, like sure.
if you're so poor that you can't get any more things, in a way, it's, you're a little bit freer. But whilst you have a little bit of leeway, it's easy to just keep chasing it again and again and again.
And, you know, as we know, a Renaissance comes up to Christmas time. So, yeah, there's all the skillful means of every marketer and advertiser coming at us, right, to get more.
It's got by the algorithms.
Well, that's right.
It's like the inner algorithm is all wrong.
Yeah, this is a solution. Even if we achieve great wealth, the fear of losing it haunts you. And rich people often worry about thieves, investments, and losing social status. Now, the solution lies in realizing that the security we're seeking cannot arise from external factors, but arises from us changing our internal attitude towards these objects. Now, like the simplest thing that they're trying, especially with these shows about hoarding, they're trying to just go contentment, isn't it? Can you just be content with these few and let the other 100 of them go? And it's very, very hard for them to be content, isn't it? It's really, they suffer a lot to be able to say, you know, I don't want the other 98, I'll let those ones go, I'll just keep these two.
Well, it becomes really obvious that you think that the happiness is in the object and...
the object provides happiness.
The object provides happiness. So of course, you have to have them all. And then Laura Beener just recently said about the thing about happiness from attachment, it doesn't grow. The more you get, your happiness doesn't grow.
No, it doesn't. You experience this yourself and you'll know this. So a little bit, this attachment. Attachment and aversion. So attachment to gain, aversion to loss. These two mental phenomena, attachment and aversion, they are exaggerated responses to the phenomena. They're exaggerated, and the exaggeration takes place because it actually appears to us as if the good qualities are in the object. You know, so we want the object. Then we will feel good, because good is in the object, you just have to possess it and it will feel better. That's the idea. But of course, once you analyze it, you see, no, this is a misconception. So we're saying that, so you know, like I notice when I go shopping, what's amazing is the containers. Aren't they amazing? Man, I was up in Baby Jones yesterday, looking at the containers of all sorts of things, and just look at the box and the tins and the boxes.
You don't even remember the things.
No, it's just what they're in. And what was really nice about it, I looked at the price of each one, I said, oh my God.
Like, what are we paying for?
It was $30. It cost $30 for, I think it was 8 chocolates, but then you look at the box and it's like, yeah, the box is amazing.
You're paying for
the box. Yeah,
paying for the box.
Yeah, these things. Okay, so we've got this. So this is this general idea. We have this idea that our attachment is this overestimation of the object and then our wish to possess it. And the other is that we want it. So I often call attachment like a sticky mind. I remember many, many years ago, I was talking with his mother, and there was a student there, and then we were talking about her, and we were trying to, describe her or something. Yeah, and your mum said, sticky.
There's another thing too I've noticed with myself, is that urge to get souvenirs. So you're somewhere, yeah. And you want to get a piece of the somewhere, yeah. Or a, yeah, piece of the experience. Yeah. And so you don't actually even care what. I mean, like teaspoon collection or tea towel collection, or just... It's that, it's a,
thing.
To possess something actually that is intangible.
Mm. I was like that in New Zealand, but then I had the baggage weight thinking in my mind. I can't take too much home. I just realised I might hire a plane to go home. So I was picking up things from every place we went to, and I'm going, I have to stop. I'm going to get charged for this, you know? Yes, I know. It's so easy.
Okay, so now what we're going to do is look at the tools we can use to overcome this attachment to gain and loss in this case. So I'll introduce you to this slide and then sort of say how it carries across to the next slide. So in terms of our progression as spiritual people trying to train ourselves. So when we begin, the tool you use most of all is impermanence. That all these phenomena are products, they come together depending upon causes and conditions, they cannot retain their appearance. That they are subject to disintegration. You cannot hold onto these objects forever. So the major thing is impermanence, but here I've put up the four thoughts, and that's because you can use impermanence all the way through, but you can also use these four thoughts in terms of renunciation, which are the thoughts of fortunate human rebirth, death of impermanence, the unsatisfactory nature of samsara and suffering.
Karmic cause and effect.
Yeah, so we have these four. I'll show you, this comes across in the next slide. So we can use anything from those four topics, and the major one being impermanence, to help us stop the aversion and the attachment. We can grab those. It was in the same topic of like renunciation. We have a giving up the cause of the suffering. That's all we're saying. We want to stop the aversion and the attachment. So here we can look at the use of karma, impermanence, and selflessness. Because now the renunciation is moving up into the middling scope. Bodhicitta in the great scope, we can use giving and taking, or called tonglen, to help you work with aversion and attachment. Impermanence, like I said, goes right across. It doesn't matter where you are in your spiritual development. All these phenomena of eight worldly concerns are all impermanent, subject to change. It's the thing is, what can you bring to it? What do you understand to help you? So like I've got here, like here we've got giving and taking. Suppose you don't know about that, but I can't use that. Impermanence, so I do know about that, I can use that here. Do you know about equality? Well, you might say, yeah, I do. Okay, I can use that. And if you know anything about emptiness, you can use that. And so, again, we come to this great scope or the teachings of the view, it's just emptiness. So emptiness is right across too. All these phenomena are all empty and they're impermanent. So that's the general tool you can use. It covers everything here. Then depending upon where you are yourself and what your understanding and your abilities are, you can use the four thoughts, karma, giving and taking, all these other different things. Do you have a question here before I whip it over to the next slide and sort of show it to you in more detail? Do you understand what I'm sort of getting at though? Yeah, so you have two major things, impermanence. You know, the first teaching the Buddha gives us on impermanence, the last teaching on impermanence. And so it's up to us. Like we know this, it's up to us then. The second phenomenon is emptiness or selflessness. This also goes across all phenomena, whether they're produced or unproduced. So those two go like everything. Then there's the terms of like, well, whereabouts are you in the path itself? Are you still trying to give up suffering and its causes? You go, yeah, I am. And so, okay, you could do four thoughts, you could do the renunciation karma. Now that's where you can pull across all the subject matter there to help you. Suppose you've been coming here for quite a few years, and those are lower scope teachings. Then we've got the middling scope and the great scope coming So what can I use there? In the middling, you can go impermanence, karma, selflessness. If you go even more, if you've been here much longer, of course, all the time in your company, you always be teaching on emptiness and bodhicitta. But there's a range of things on the other path. So, but you have to sort of work after it. So if you have, and you've sort of got some idea of how this works, you can go, then I can use Tong Len. I can do exchanging self and others. I can use equalizing self and others. I can use knowledge of impermanence. I can also use my knowledge of emptiness.
So how would you do Tong Len in regard to hoarders?
Okay, so are you the hoarder, or are the hoarders external to
you? Say I have a massive hoarding tendency.
Okay.
But, I mean, you know, then you watch the shows as well, so both.
So we know that hoarding is a source of suffering. So then what you do is you imagine all the other hoarders that have all been suffering. You take away their attachment from them. You bring it into your heart. By the exhaling of breath, you give them contentment. It's the major thing, to be content. And so out of compassion, you take the causes of their suffering. You imagine it coming towards you. Black light comes into your heart, strikes your indifference towards them.
Mm-hmm.
And now you go back at them, say, may you be content, may you feel at ease. Imagine that they are content and that they are at ease. So that's how you might use Tong Len in that way. If you were to use emptiness, for instance, you'd look for, wow, all these disturbing emotions are coming out of my misapprehension of the, you know, the goods, whatever they are. And so I've got to actually realize that the phenomena themselves are empty of any inherent existence. I myself am empty of any inherent existence. And the people I'm concerned about are empty of any inherent existence. It's called the three empty spheres. You, activity of hoarding, and the hoarder or the other person who wishes to free of it, all of them are empty of intrinsic nature. So all of their behaviors can change. That's what it's all saying. Because you understand, there's no intrinsic nature here. There's just dependence arising. Hoarding can be changed. These people can become much better. They can become healthier. It's hoarding and these people and myself, there's no intrinsic nature there. If there was intrinsic nature, nothing could be changed. But because it's not, because it's empty of intrinsic nature, everything can be changed. Everything functions. So these people can recognize the hoarding and the source of their suffering, just like I do, and change themselves. Anyway, so I'm giving you some clues. So let's look at this table I've drawn up. And I'll just go across it. So here, these are just examples, right? So I know it's pretty full on that when you look at the other card, and that's fine. This is sort of like when you have your own time, you're going to sort of look at it on the thing and go through and go, oh, what can I do if I use perfect human rebirth? If I wanted to take what I know about perfect human rebirth and use that to prevent attachment to gain and aversion to loss. So in this life, as human beings, so we'll just take this perfect human rebirth and take this one first. So as the perfect human rebirth is called that because you're free from some things and you have other things. They support your path. So what do people normally do with their lives?
Try to enjoy them.
Yeah, and they accumulate possessions. Mm. Right? This is the thing here. We're accumulators, right? And we want to feel good. These are the two things.
Get your house set up.
Yeah, so you want to accumulate. Well, you know, all the things that take, which are really all external to us.
Retirement fund.
Yeah, they're all external to us. They can't provide the security we seek. So instead of putting all your energy in that, you go, no, actually, loving kindness is the better thing to develop. Intelligence is better for me. It's got greater, it's the only thing I can take with me. I can't take anything that's physical when I come to die. So I need to put, need to be less obsessed about just this life and prepare for future lives as well. Of course, I need a place to live. Don't be obsessive about it. Yeah, I need one where I really used to be content. You try to develop, you make it not the major thing, it could be second, third, a bit down the line. You think, no, the major thing is here, whether I have a big house or a small house, I need to be happy. Right? Whether I've got one or whether I've got one or not got one, I still want to be happy. So the major thing here is I need to accumulate good mental qualities and not physical stuff. I'm not going to spend my life doing that. Then when you lose things, you can just say like, well, of course I've lost it. It's natural for these phenomena to disintegrate, for them to be lost. They're physical things. I can't hold on to them anyway. And actually, when you lose them, you feel, great, one more impediment against my liberation. God. In fact, whoever finds it, may they be happy. You know? So whatever you lose is like helping you. And whatever you like have, you sort of look at it and go, yeah, well, it's lovely I've got this, but it's not the real source of my happiness, is it? If there's anything external to you, you go, no, I love that bus. It's nice. It's a good bus. But it can't be the source of my happiness. It's just a great bus in my house. So something like that. So that's just for this one. With death and impermanence, as you can see here, it don't matter what you gain. Anything physical is all you will not be able to take it with you. Neither your reputation. There's so much you will have to leave behind. Even your name will be left behind. And so this is on that side. So you go, wow, there's a whole thing straight there, you know? Yeah, so you can also just try to put some different things up so you can go through like with suffering. So they say, seeking satisfaction through gaining material phenomena is like drinking salt water to quench your thirst. Mm-hmm. It's not going to work. And so I thought, I'm just trying to like set up like a thing like this so you can go, oh, within each stage of the path, there's something useful I can take from it to help me work against attachment and aversion to gain and loss and feelings of pleasure and pain and so forth. Like I said, so impermanence runs all the way through reason, whether it's the big one, and so there's selflessness or emptiness that runs right across. And you've got individual things at the same time.
For the karma one, when I've lost money, I've often just thought, okay, that's a karmic debt paid off.
Yep.
Yeah.
And it just makes it really, it releases my mind
that way. That's right. This is what they often, this is the idea, one of the great benefits of suffering. It's like it's a broom to sweep away the past causes. This has actually happened, it's going to happen once. Things will be glad. Oh, great, that's out of the way. Thank goodness that's over. So you guys get the general idea here? I'm just trying to say to you, each stage of the path that we study, whether it be perfect human rebirth, death and impermanence, there are solutions in there for particular problems. And the problems we're facing here is attachment and aversion. That's the major thing here. So you can find aspects within each of these steps to help you do that. Because you'll find you have attachment to lots of things. The biggest one, of course, will be to yourself. And so we need to find out where we sort of go wrong and then write it, make it right by the right sort of thinking that goes wrong. There's a quote from the Buddha. He says, "The wise and mindful person knows them and sees that they are subject to change. Desirable conditions don't excite his mind, nor is he repelled by undesirable conditions." So the wise and mindful person, the word mindfulness here, the wise, so a wise person understands the nature of this phenomenon, impermanent, and which is mindful means you remember. You remember, these things are subject to change internally. They don't have the qualities within them, but I think they do have. Yeah. How do I know? Because I've looked, I analysed. The qualities are not from that side. All the qualities come from your side, basically, you're intriguing them. You can't find it over there. But you need to look there first before you go and start there. So don't just listen to me or the books and things. You actually have to look. See what you thought was there is not there. Then you know. It's not just believing anymore, but you know that what you thought was there is not there. You did not find it there. But it's not that it's non-existent, it's actually coming from you. But again, you won't find it from your side. You go searching. That's what I say, it's these three spheres, you know? Subject, object, action. We're all empty of the intrinsic nature of a subject, object, action. They exist, but dependently. So anyway, yeah, so we'll just stop here for a moment. Sandy.
Failure and success. It's the imposters they are.
That's right.
You'll be a man, my friend.
That's what right. If. Rudyard Kipling.
Yeah. It's so similar.
That's right. That's a very good thing you pointed out. I was trying to remember that. I love that part. It really suits here, isn't it? But the same thing, if you don't have this attachment or aversion, then you're sort of growing up.
I was reading How to Practice Dharma, and Lama's over at Rinpoche lists the eight worldly dharmas. And then in the footnote, actually, the editor says that in other teachings, Rinpoche has used different terms to describe the eight worldly dharmas. So craving for material possessions. He also, in this, in for material possessions, he also says getting what you want, and for happiness and unhappiness, he's also said interesting things. And so it made me think, well, how does that apply to coming to a class like this? Like, this is interesting to us, and it brings us pleasure and enjoyment to some degree. So how do we, and like going to retreats and things, like we know that it's good to do and beneficial, but there's still interesting things. So how does that work?
Well, like I said, so the most important thing is the intention.
Okay.
This is really what it all comes down to. And, you know, before we talked about the eight worldly concerns being white, black, or mixed.
Yeah.
So this is where this comes in. You know, when you sort of ask me, gosh, you know, is there attachment here or not? If there is, at what level is it?
Yeah, because also I've noticed with classes, you know, there's the popular classes like this, it's a really juicy topic, but death and impermanence, nobody likes it, and nobody comes until someone dies, and then it's too late.
Right.
Because then it's like, well, geez, I wish I had done this class beforehand, because then I would have known what to do when someone dies. So that's like this whole thing, aversion to unpleasant topics. Yeah.
But are really useful, aren't they?
They're really useful.
But then they become interesting. So it's like,
should I really everyone should not be engaged in too much. That's the thing.
Yeah.
It's like there's quite a difference in the presentation between Lama's Opus one and His Holiness's one. And I was sort of thinking about why that might be. I don't know really, but in my own mind, I come up with an idea.
Probably different scopes, approaches.
Yeah, so I think Lama's Opus is quite strong.
Yeah,
radical.
That's right. So from the perspective of the person who reads it, maybe that's exactly what they need, this strong approach, right? But it may not be. So if you were reading a strong approach, like, oh my gosh, blah, 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 then it's got this holiness approach. Which is much more, I think, this holiness approach is like for the general. No, that was like for Buddhists, right?
Uncompromising.
No compromising. Right? Ordinary people, we give much more leeway and a much nicer explanation, right? So don't worry too much. This is the thing, it'll stop you being a Dharma person. Yeah, it's like really terrible way to get the other concerns, right? Because if you took any notice at all, it would help you. And that's, I think that's the same intention as Holiness says, and with Lama's open. He says, you know, sometimes you really got to push somebody, but sometimes the gentle approach is the better one.
Ruby, don't you find that whole thing that it's very easy to apply that, oh, emptiness and impermanence, when other people are suffering, but when it's like me suffering, no, excuse me,
yeah.
And we don't do it to ourselves.
So the learning goes through sort of stages. So one of the learnings, so I was saying to Liffy and another person, yeah, just because I know a great deal about the human body does not mean I'm skilled enough to take your heart out. So what that means is like, okay, so we know a lot about impermanence and emptiness. Does this mean we can apply it skillfully to our lives? You'll find no. And we only know this through your own experience. Sometimes you'll be good, sometimes you're not. So it's a real, we talk about learning as a Buddhist, we start off with study, isn't it? The first thing is study, like come to know what are these eight worldly concerns. That's the first part. Then the second part goes, now reflect on, now think about it. So you need to think quite long about this and be very certain about the conclusions we've come to. And okay, there is that now you need to become familiar with it. So that means like familiar is like applying it.
Practice. Yeah.
Practice. Are you practicing it? So you know, like this is just the way it is, Ruby. You know, so it's like I said, for me, it's quite simple to read through this and go, oh, yeah, I agree. But when it comes to the way I live my life, heck, I'm still out there and I look at all these beautiful things and go, oh, that's so great. I'd like that. Where would I put it? You know, I've got all these problems because my mind is going, more, grab. Yeah, we all do it. Yeah. So it takes a lot of, and that's because this is the habit, because this is the habit we've built up, Rick. So I saw these kids in the shop yesterday, too, poor dears, like screaming out for the thing. So, I mean, you look at it, they look gorgeous. Of course they want them. And it's, why can't they have them? Mum's going, yeah. You know, and we all know we were like that once. You know, I'd really cry. I'd cry if I didn't get what I wanted. Then I'd get it and I'd break it. And so great, yeah, and then smash it. I don't care. Move on. What happened? I'll have another one. Yeah, so it does take, like I said, knowing this, like there's these levels of the white, the black, the mixed. You know, so it's going to take time, and that's why I sort of like those holiness. Don't overly concerned with this, don't obsess about them so much. And you can see other people do it, you'll know whether you're like that or not, and whether that can bring about more suffering. You know, it's a meditation, just keep quite a comfortable posture. Drop your shoulders and place your hands where they feel at ease, and just let your body breathe itself. We want to discover for ourselves a sense of security that can't be shaken by external events. And we want to do this to be of benefit to ourselves and others. So an altruistic intention is being set up. And we want to investigate our relationship with gain and loss. See how we cling to one and fear the other. Now, a wise person understands that the problem is not gain or loss themselves. It's our mind's response to gain and loss. So when the mind attaches itself to gains, the mind becomes unstable. And any state of peace that we have will be interrupted and changed. So when we're attached to external objects, a peaceful state of mind becomes unstable and as fleeting as a dewdrop on a blade of grass. So why does our pursuit of external security so often lead to more anxiety? Our pursuit of external security often leads to more anxiety because we're trying to control the uncontrollable wind of life instead of skillfully adjusting the sails of our attitude. So how might you recognize when you're drinking the salt water of attachment in your own life? You feel it as though it's a restless thirst for more. And this is a sign that you're seeking happiness from a source that can never truly quench your desire. So when sailors are out on the water, you know, they cannot control the wind, but they can adjust the sails of their craft. This is something we can all do. So in a moment of loss or gain, what is the most skillful adjustment you can make? The most skillful adjustment is to meet the experience with a balanced mind. So you're neither clinging nor you're pushing away. You're simply navigating the present moment. Try to remember that your true wealth is this unshakable, equanimous mind. This is your safe harbor in any storm. So, seek that safe harbor. And breathing in through your nostrils, exhale through your mouth, let your eyes flutter open if they're closed. So So now the next one I've done, we've done sort of ownership. Possessions. So we looked at possessions and the ways of gain and loss of aversion and attachment. So now we look towards feelings. And in particular, we mean by physical feelings, feelings associated with the senses. And there's different ways of explaining this. So I've had this picture, so it's like a metaphor. And that's what the bubbles are representing here. So when they talk about feelings, they talk about the nature of our feelings. So when feelings are discussed, they're usually discussed as of three types. There are the pleasant feelings or unpleasant feelings, or what they call neutral feelings. And the neutral feelings just mean you can't discern quite yet is if they're pleasant or unpleasant. The other ones we can easily put into these two categories, right? Pleasant, unpleasant. One way of looking at the terms of the bubbles here. So like I said, so impermanence goes across everything, and so does selflessness or emptiness. So in terms of impermanence, the idea of the bubbles is not like this. This idea of bubbles is for selflessness or emptiness. So when we talk about impermanence, the picture is usually the idea you want to get in your head, and you can do this quite easily next time it rains. So just watch what happens when raindrops hit puddles. You want a body of water, and you want to watch the raindrop hit it. So what happens is the force of the rain comes down, it hits the surface, and it creates a bubble. And it pops, and it's gone. That's what feelings are like. They're sort of disintegrating the moment they're produced. It's that fast. That's the actual way it is. Of course, because when we cling, now it's pulled out, elongated, we feel much, much more. We're actually feeling the real thing, we're holding on to our concept of it, the idea. But the feeling itself is like just that one moment, and then the bubble appears, it's gone. When we use the bubble analogy for emptiness, then we say, well, all feelings are empty. Just like the bubble, the soap bubble that comes up like this is actually empty of any engine, isn't it? Looks lovely on the outside, it can be, isn't it? When you get that lovely shimmering surface, it looks like a real thing. But that thing is empty of any anything inside it, there's nothing there. If we use that idea for ourselves, we go like, here's our bubble, the body. We look for ourselves within it. We're not there. It's like there's nothing inside the bubble. But any sort of feeling you look into it, again, you will not find the feeling. The actual feelings, like I said, they're just like a... So all the relation is actually our thought of the feeling, the concept of feeling. So is that, you know, is this concept actual feeling? You go, no, it's not. That's the name, feeling. And so it also lacks its intrinsic nature. So these periods of pleasure and pain to relate to physical feeling by focusing specifically on our automatic mental reactions to liking pleasant sensory experiences and strong dislike for discomfort or painful feelings. The emotional reactivity is rooted in the belief that these fleeting physical sensations are reliable sources of enduring happiness or true suffering. Well, that's actually what's taking place, yes. But read that, but that's not actually, that's the reality. But what happens to us is that's not what happens. But as we hold on to it.
So with the more serious ones, we engage in them because we're trying to work them out.
Yeah, it's like kind of, it's how we engage, really. It's the response to the stimuli. That's going to create the suffering or the release from it. It's just that these phenomena appear to have an intrinsic nature. Feelings. I mean, everything does. Anything that convincingly exists is going to have this appearance of intrinsic reality. And we're going to believe it. We believe it. So we hold it. We like I said, belief and grasping and holding, they're all the same thing, basically. Different words to describe the phenomenon. Like, for instance, like, so when you experience a pain, what happens in terms of, like, if you're going to pay interest in it? So mental pain, physical pain.
Usually with physical pain, you recoil.
Right. Yeah.
That's what happens.
So how do you, when you experience physical pain, right, are you the physical pain itself? You also know. I'm definitely not the physical pain. Of course you're not. Are you something separate from that physical pain?
No.
No. It appears if you are separate from it, is if you have it. It's something you possess. You ever say yes, but you don't exist like that. There's all things about how it propagates and how we hold on to it wrongly. Wrong sense of self, wrong sense of feeling. We're having a feeling how it doesn't exist intrinsically, but we think it does. Right, so this is why. Yeah, that's right. No self, no pain. Exactly. Yeah, no true self, no true pain.
Does that mean then in experience, in our experience, it stops being so painful and just is more an intense experience?
Well, it is, yes, it is an intense experience. Like, remember here again, it's not like the suffering does not exist. That's not the case. It does exist. We experience painful feelings, and the feelings are called painful. That all exists. But again, it's like, although they exist, we have a sort of unconscious reactivity towards it as if it truly existed. Where it doesn't truly exist, it dependently exists. But we're apprehending and behaving as if it truly exists. So the word truly exists here just means it exists in the way it's appearing to me. So when pain appears to you, that's really a great time to look at it right in the face. Like, pay attention now, because you want to know, like, how does it exist? How's it appearing to exist? Because if you don't, this is the way you get it, the selfness of the phenomenon. You have to identify the phenomenon and the responses you're having towards it. And you look and say, is that actually the case? We're really interested in how the phenomena exist, how they relate. That way we get the selfness and the emptiness of it, and then we can use that idea. Again, like, if you can't, we'll have to. That's just the thing. It's really useful. If you can't, then you come to impermanence. Use impermanence or any of those other stages beneath emptiness. That's where you've always got something to use against these problems. And if you don't want to, you know, do that, and you go after, okay, these things here, for instance. You know, how can I use my thinking in terms of perfect human rebirth, death and impermanence? How do I use my thinking in the small scope, middle, great scope? You know, am I trying to develop a renunciation, body, truth, or the view? What do I want to do here? So what you often find yourself doing is what you're most familiar with. You find a thing that works, go there. Use that. Which you become really familiar with it, you can use it, perhaps okay, now look for a second tool. Like, oh, maybe now it's time to look at the same people's thing. Yeah, so again, so like in pain, right? So we've got, you know, a painful feeling. So suppose you've come here to sit and meditate, and say, no, I don't like meditating, why not? Well, my back gets so sore, my shoulders get so sore. It's like, it's painful to sit there for so long. You go, yeah, it is. So now you're averse to Dharma practice, right? I don't want to come and meditate. It's painful. So, yeah, it's not as bad as the pain in the lower arm, right? It's nothing. Right? So sure, you can put up with it. Yeah, I've seen people really upset their house is burnt down, you know, they can't get it. But what they're really upset about is all the photos of gone. And then the people's comment on it is that, you know, we want the memories, all the memories have gone. Actually, yeah, the memories aren't out there.
That's what they said, all of our, that literal quote of this person, how it's conflated in our mind that all the photos are gone, all our memories are gone. Gone. And they actually said that. And I'm like, how can that be?
Did you get amnesia?
But it really, it's a tell, isn't it? It's a societal tell of how we think the memories are in the photos.
Yeah, that's right.
They're not in our mind, they're in the
photos. And all the good things are like out there.
Yeah. It's just, that approach is in everything.
And so, you know, people get, what's the other one, where they get, people, like I say, carry knickknacks and those little things in the house, and they remember, because of that. Sort of a
sentimental
value. That's right, when they get lost or broken and the people get really upset. It's a little gone too far. And so we don't want to do the same. That's the wonderful thing, you look at other people's suffering, the idea is, well, don't do the same.
We do that with kids. When the kids lose their favourite rubber band and cry, it's like, oh, it's just rubber band, but we don't do it with our own selves.
That's right. Yeah, so again, when you're the good feelings, so what would it be to say? Every feeling, all feelings are associated with karma. Of course they are. But so if you have a feeling, it's a life's an effect. So that's what it's karma. So when you really have good feelings or bad feelings, they're not really yours. They've just come about because of karmic causes and conditions. Again, if you go looking for an owner that has this, you don't find one.
That's like the selflessness. But she also said about the feelings that come from within, they can grow. The happiness can grow.
Yeah, that's right. And so,
but the happiness from the outs, external things, the happiness can't grow.
No. So that's why I have to talk a bit about cultivate your happiness. Cultivate the sources of happiness. Find out what they are. Cultivate them. Become familiar with them. Because we're already familiar with a lot of wrong ideas, of course. We suffer immensely because of them. And, for many of us, we don't know what those wrong ideas are. Or how they come into formation. There's different ways. Again, it just comes to impermanence, selflessness, right across the board. And then you can go to each of the three principal aspects. Now, renunciation, the major thing here is I've got to stop myself from suffering. But I come up to the middle scope, it's really about karma and selflessness here. Renunciation of suffering, then karma, we know, produces it, everything is selfless and empty. Finally, we get up to the great scope, bodhicitta, thought transformation, giving and taking, emptiness, so forth. Does this sort of just try to get across to you? Hopefully, get across. There are a lot of solutions here, and they spread right out through the land room. But if you were to gather them all together, you could go basically they are impermanence, and selflessness, emptiness. There's a very major two. This is Mahayana teachings. So the next thing will be bodhicitta. How can I use what is a loss or painful? How can I use them skillfully to help me in my path? And when I have attachment on the other side, how can I temper that down? So it's not so prevalent in my life. Okay, this will be our next meditation. So again, just be comfortable in your seat. Drop your shoulders, straighten your back. Place your hands where they feel at ease. And just let your body breathe itself. And then set an altruistic intention to stop being carried away by your feelings and the centrifine is sort of a stable and unshakable piece within. We're going to have a look at our automatic habit of clinging to pleasant feelings and the pushing away of painful ones. Now, the mind that is wise with Dharma understands that this reactivity is the true source of our disturbance. It's not the feelings themselves. This constant chase and resistance makes our inner peace as fragile and fleeting as a water bubble. Like a bubble, every feeling, pleasant or painful, arises, shivers for a moment, and then vanishes without a trace. So why do we suffer when we cling to pleasant feelings? We can't hold onto them. It's like trying to grab a water bubble, which by its very nature can't be held. So this ensures frustration. In a moment of physical pain, how might this insight help? Well, it allows us to see our pain, to not be so rigid and solid. The pain may appear as a shimmering, ever-changing bubble. This will reduce fear and resistance to the transient nature of pain. What would happen to the self that has experienced these feelings when we see feelings to be just like bubbles? The sense of a solid self also reveals itself to be like a bubble. It's just a temporary formation. It's not a permanent owner of the experience. Our true nature is more like just this calm water from which all the bubbles of experience briefly arise and return. And breathe in through nostrils. Exhale. So, Aryanagarjuna says in his friendly letter, gain and loss, pleasure and pain, fame and disrepute and praise and disparagement are the eight worldly concerns. Equalize these so they are not objects of your mind. Maybe one simple way we can equalize them all.
Ask the question again. Give me
this is equalize these so they are not objects of one's mind. So how would you equalize these eight world concerns? How can you see that they're all the same equally? They're all empty. I've inherited this. That's not right across the board. Each one is the same. They're all equal to one another. Belonging to what else?
They'll all change.
They'll all change. That's right. That's the other thing. Equalize them. They're all impermanent, all transient, all without any self nature. So that way they're exactly all the same. I've been preparing for a course next year, and the course is on the Diamond Cutter Sutra. You know, I've been going through it, and what's really popping out all the time is non-attachment, non-attachment, non-attachment. So this idea of aversion is just another form of attachment too. I mean, both, it's just aversion goes like, pump up the negative side, only focus on the negative. So you know, there's nothing likable about it. That's how it appears to the mind. On the other side, everything's likable. None of the unlikable stuff appears, only what's likable, and it appears to be within the object, just like the unlikable side. They're both, it's the same, except one goes up and one goes down. One you're exaggerating, one is denigrating.
So is detachment, does that also apply to aversion? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, that's right. To get it off, stop being averse. Detach yourself from this aversion type of mind you have. Get yourself off from this attachment mind, this overestimation. Get yourself off of seeing it like it's all impermanent. Whether it's good or bad, it's impermanent. That's how you sort of get off the aversion thing. It's also like equalize or they're both empty of intrinsic nature. They have no intrinsic nature there. This sort of idea that makes everything, you know, stable, sort of flattens out, flattens the mind out. Because remember, attachment is you've overestimated something, so you're wrong. You can have attachment to virtuous actions too. You can overestimate them. That, actually, overestimating the virtuous actions, that's what we call good karma. Yeah, it keeps you right in the cycle of existence, but makes it good. Right?
Yeah,
but that's because of attachment.
People want to.
Yeah. So here, Ruby, the thing is with attachment, there's two parts of it. One is this particular Buddhist word, what is it? It's this overestimation of, so for instance, attachment to the good, right? We overestimate the good qualities. How, in what way are we overestimating? You could say, you could ask, right? So, well, when I look at that object, none of the negative or bad qualities are appearing to my mind. Only the good are appearing. And so when that happens, you've got attachment. Right? The second thing is you want that object. You want to possess it. So this is, so then, and you don't want to be separated from it either. Like you want it and you want to hold on to it. So this is the second aspect of it. The one is the mental thing where you're over exaggerating, thinking that all the qualities are actually intrinsic, you know, and so forth. This is the wrong thing. But then comes this next bit of, you know, of
wanting to possess it.
Like His Holiness gives that great example where he loves watches, you know. And so he can play this little game with himself to watch the attachment cup to check, do I have attachment or not? So he'd go down the mall, he'd look at the shop window, and there's a good watch in the window, right? He likes it. And he says, I like it. Yeah, for sure. You have to,
it's like the difference between window shopping or shopping.
Shopping, I like window shopping.
So window shopping you can only do if you've got it, like you have a content mind.
Yeah.
So for attachment to really occur, do you need the second, like, I want to? So can you you can't see the negative qualities in a person, for example. Yeah. And you don't know them long enough and you remember them by being good life.
Sure.
But you don't, you're like, okay, they're gone from my life, I'm okay with that. Is that still attachment? If we only remember them as good.
If they are actually good, yeah, no, that's not attachment. But in general, ordinary people are all good.
Yeah, I suppose, like, just generally, you think, oh, yeah, someone's a good person and you're not that attached, so you're not craving. But say if you find out something later on bad about them, you're disappointed. So then that indicates that it was.
Oh, actually, there was a attachment, so I just didn't know.
Yeah, realize it, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, that's a good example, I think. Okay, so the idea here is to transform the mind. The way we do that is just check them, what's going on. You know, you have to look at what is my mind doing in relation to whatever object it encounters. So many years ago, we had these exams up at CI about this sort of material. You know? So they give you like real world problems. Like, what do you do when you're standing behind somebody in the line of social security? This is our question, right? And you find you're looking at a really good looking person. And you feel attracted to them because they're great looking. What do you do?
Yeah,
that's the one that really, for beginning monks and nuns, you know what they do? They look down. They don't look at the object. That's one of the simplest things you can do. Pull your senses away from the object. Put it somewhere else. That's the first thing, the simplest thing anybody
can do. That's why I do my shopping like grocery shopping online, because I don't impulse buy. I just buy the exact same things that I bought last time, and that's it. Because I don't get to see anything else. I don't get to see all those beautiful tins you've been talking about.
When I was asked to go shopping, I said no. I went out here. I don't want to go and do that again. Yeah, so here I've got this, two people on the piano. One's really good and one's not so good. So one's making a whole lot of noise and one is playing it well. And that's what you check, right? Is your mind making a whole lot of noise or is it in the flow of Dharma? You're the only one that knows. No one else knows. So you have to check. And, really the core insight takeaway from all of this is that our suffering does not arise from external events. Happiness, things aren't out there making you happy or making you unhappy. It's your mind's interpretation of it. It's what your mind does with these events. The aversion, the attachment, this is the thing. We need to be able to acknowledge what our mind does and then change it. Even if you have to, in our exam, if you just look down, that'll change your mind.
So didn't they also say don't go shopping on an empty stomach?
Yeah.
Which kind of points to you have to have a sense of contentment before you go out into the world where you're in big trouble.
That's right, that's what says it, eat before you go shopping. Well, it's true, you'll notice, right? Anyway, this is very important. So which we've just seen in our class. So you have some idea about the faults of aversion and attachment in relation to the objects of possession and our feelings. So we've got gain and loss, pain and pleasure. How to practice Dharma? While I was over the Bishay, we might have some books upstairs with you, perhaps.
There's that one in the shop, and also there's the teachings from Tibet is one of the free books. So if you
so there is a section in there we're teaching on the eight worldly concerns. And this is where he does mention the grey and the black and the mixed and that sort of thing. So next week we'll do the same setup like this, but we'll just go through praise and blame and fame and disrepute. So due to the merits of his virtuous actions, I have quickly attained the state of a Guru Buddha. A lead all living beings without exception to that enlightened state. May the supreme jewel, bodhicitta, not yet born, arise and grow. May that born have no decline but increase evermore. And as long as space remains, as long as sentient beings remain, may I too remain to the stars, stars of the world. And the prayer for us, the long life of His Holiness. The wish granting, wish fulfilling jewel, source of every single benefit and happiness in this world. To the incomparably kind Tenzin Gyatso, I beseech, may all your holy wishes be spontaneously fulfilled. And lastly, for the quick finding of the authentic reincarnation, In holding and spreading the luminous, precious and complete teachings for explanation and practice, you wore the armor of patience and have never discouraged. Incomparable Venerable Guru, dear Amethyst. Okay, well, so thank you very much for attending class. Good to see you. Have a good week.